Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. 100 years ago, W.C. Handy made blues history by publishing two landmark songs, the St. Louis Blues and the Yellow Dog Blues. We now know that W.C. Handy didn't so much write these songs as he scraped them together from bits and pieces of other songs that he heard in rural parts of the South. But that's okay. That's how music works. You always build on the stuff that came before. And when I say you, I mean you, sitting at home listening to us. We're going to let you in on how you can remake the Yellow Dog Blues as part of a radio homework assignment. We've also got live music from Diego Garcia, the former indie rocker who's now mining his own South American roots. And that's okay, too. Everybody's music has roots somewhere. Here, listen to this hit song from Frank Sinatra.
Full moon and empty arms. The moon is there for us to share.
Lovely tune, no doubt about it, credited to Ted Mossman and Buddy Kay. Problem is, they didn't actually write it. This guy did. Sergei Rachmaninoff and his Piano Concerto No. 2 provided the melody for that Frank Sinatra song. Now, does knowing that the tune was lifted from someone else make you feel differently about the song? Probably not. But tracing the roots of where a song comes from can be fun. Or it can be a lifelong fixation, especially for fans of this singer.
Full moon and empty arms. The moon is there for us to share, but where are you?
Bob Dylan recently surprised fans by posting a brand new song to his website. It's a cover of the 1945 Frank Sinatra hit Full Moon and Empty Arms. It's reported to be the first track from an upcoming album from the 72-year-old singer, whose last release, Tempest, came out in 2012. But for a select group of fans, the so-called Dylanologists, this is just another chapter to explore in an entire lifetime worthy of study, preservation, and, let's face it, obsession. Joining me here in the studio is David Kinney, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist whose new book is called The Dylanologists. David, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Let's define our terms here. On the spectrum from fan to absolute wacko obsessive, who are the Dylanologists? Where do they exist?
I take a broad look at that term. I mean, I'll say that it's anybody who would be considered sort of a Dylan expert by regular people out in the real world. Now, that probably includes more people than would admit to being called Dylanologists. I mean, the trouble with the term is that it was invented by A.J. Weberman, and A.J. Weberman has come to be reviled in this community for his analysis of Dylan songs, not just necessarily for going through his garbage in the 60s, but for, you know, coming up with these outlandish theories that Dylan is a closet racist and Holocaust denier and all that stuff.
So this is the guy, A.J. Weberman, this is the guy that Dylan actually punches and then, you know, takes his Dylan Liberation Front pin off and then...
So AJ says.
So AJ says. Well, it's in your book too. So now, a very telling thing that you've already said is the phrase "in the real world." Do the Dylanologists exist in some other world?
There's definitely a Dylan universe. I mean, the subtitle of the book is "Adventures in the Land of Bob," and you know there is this. Kind of side universe where he seems to dominate like a skyscraper or something. I mean, he's got a record out or a compilation out or a book out, or there's something sort of going on at any moment. And I think that the Dylan crowd just sort of feeds on that, feeds on his ubiquitousness. Even though he's this very private person, he's, right. he seems to be everywhere.
Why Dylan, though? I mean, there are plenty of other mammoth figures out there. You know, Michael Jackson was certainly a huge, iconic figure in 20th century American pop culture. Why Dylan?
It's difficult to like, not be snobbish, you know, when you talk about this sort of thing. I mean,
Are you a Dylanologist, David Kinney?
I think I've become a Dylanologist by spending 3 years looking at this whole thing. You know, I think that Dylan is different from, say, being a Major League Baseball fan. So there's some – there's some surface parallels, right? You can go to a bunch of games a year. You can follow the box score. Dylan fans sort of follow the set list, follow his tour. He does 100 shows a year. So there is some parallels there. I mean, I think that the thing that makes Dylan interesting and has made it sort of a lifelong thing for many people is that he's been doing different stuff over 50 years. He doesn't sort of sit still and mm-hmm. keep producing the same records. And there is that aura of mystique and myth that he's cloaked himself in. I mean, he's kept his private life private. He's kept the questions about what the songs mean as if that means anything. He's not talked about that, and he's left it up to his listeners to sort of fill that void, which is the way it should be. And his work just sort of rewards deep dives into it. I mean, you can listen to songs at different points in your life, and they'll do different things. You'll have different reactions mm-hmm. to them, sort of like a great novel.
So, you know, you point out several times in the book, you know, that Dylan has said in this or that interview that there's nothing to explain, that, you know, if he had to explain his songs, he wouldn't be able to. They're just – those were the songs. That's how they came out. And, you know, it's up to someone else to figure out what it means to them.
Right. He said, go ask my audience if you want to know. Nobody – you know, the media was always asking me, what does it mean? And they never went to the audience and said, what do you think it means?
Yeah.
And I think that's valid.
So in terms of – I don't want to give the impression that these people are all nuts and cranks in your book. They are obsessive, but some of them have made real contributions to musicology, right?
Sure. You know, somebody like Scott Warmoth is a great example. So this is a disc jockey in Albuquerque who, when he was growing up, his dad worked in a pressing plant, and so he brought home records, and Scott listened to everything that you could think of. And he didn't just listen to it. He was one of those kids who would go to the library and try and figure out the history behind the music. And so that led him into a career as a disc jockey, and he's just a guy who has this encyclopedic knowledge of music. So fast forward to 2001, and Dylan releases Love and Theft, which is a record that's filled with quotation. It's filled with allusions, playfully.
As the title indicates.
As the title would suggest. The title itself is a quotation. And, you know, Scott sort of joined this crowd that was trying to figure out what came from where. Eventually, that grew into this project of looking at Dylan's memoir, Chronicles, which he has shown includes phrases from all over the place, mm-hmm. from Hemingway, from Jack London, from Time Magazine, from a Joe Esterhaus book. I mean, it's all over the map.
So the record you're talking about, Love and Theft, which came out in 2001, there's this song called Summer Days, and he's alluding to, quoting from, The Great Gatsby here.
Well, and it's sort of a classic quote. I mean, it's sort of a neatly nested in-joke. You know, he says, the line is, you can't repeat the past. You know, what do you mean you can? Of course you can. And so it's a quote, but it's also, you know, commenting on what he's doing. And so it's just, I think it's fabulous.
This is from Bob Dylan's record, Love and Theft, the song Summer Days.
Looking into my eyes, she's holding my hand. She looking into my eyes, she's holding my hand. She said you can't repeat the past. I say you can't. What do you mean you can't? Of course you can. Cut from, where do you go? Sorry, that's nothing you would need to know. Well, my back has been to the wall so long, it seemed like it's stuck. Why don't you break my heart one more time, just for good luck?
A little bit of Summer Days from Bob Dylan with a little assist from F. Scott Fitzgerald there. From the album called Love and Theft. It is a knowing, a winking title from Bob Dylan from 2001. Because, as David Kinney has told us, the songs are full of allusions and quotations and outright liftings from other things. David Kinney's book is called The Dylanologists. It is out now. It's subtitled Adventures in the Land of Bob. Let me come back to something else that goes to something we were talking about earlier, the fact that some of these obsessives have made major contributions. Bootlegging. Now, I know there's a whole branch of the music industry that does not view that as any kind of contribution, but let's face it, you know, bootlegs have brought to our attention lots of, you know, recordings that we otherwise never would have heard, and it really begins with the Dylanologists, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there was a number of guys in the early 60s who were searching for these things and trying to get them in the best possible sound quality and save it for history. I mean, they viewed Dylan as an important figure. One of the early guys was a New Yorker who was into jazz, and there was a whole sort of bootlegging culture in jazz that he already knew about, and so he sort of transplanted that onto Dylan. And, you know, these early guys, AJ was one of them, were finding these tapes and sharing them with people. Mm-hmm. And the idea was, you know, very much of that age of trying to, make the music free. Now, once it became a business, once Great White Wonder comes out and these guys are selling actual bootleg records as opposed to just trading tapes for free or for a couple of dollars or whatever, that's when it changes.
Right. That's when it crosses the lines. I mean, this whole thing has so much in the way of kind of predicting big thorny issues that would face the music world in
sure.
the digital age. But we're talking about the 1960s. And what is the importance of the Great White Wonder?
Well, it was the first. You know, one of the guys in the book is a guy by the name of Mitch Blank, who remembers standing in line for a concert and some guy, you know, walking around with a bag filled with these things. And he's like, what? This exists? And so it was just this eye-opening thing that, oh, you know, there's music behind the music, and we can get it. And so for him and others like him, I mean, it continues to this day. There's stuff that doesn't circulate. There's stuff that people have in their attics that they don't want to let go of. Mm-hmm. And so that hunt continues. And, you know, there's amazing stuff that's still out there, which is kind of for people who love Dylan and have heard virtually everything. That's just sort of this hopeful thing that there's something out there that I haven't heard before.
Right. Well, there's probably a lot of people who have not heard The Great White Wonder. It is not stellar sound quality at all, but this is Dylan, and it sounds like the band.
I believe so, yeah.
Running through some demo tapes, including this version of a song called Too Much of Nothing.
Too much of nothing can make a man abuse a king. He can walk the streets and boast like most, but he won't know a thing. Now it's all been done before, it's all been written in the book. But when there's too much of nothing, nobody should look. Say hello to Valerie, say hello to
from the 1968-69 bootleg album called The Great White Wonder, Bob Dylan with Too Much of Nothing. And bootlegging certainly becomes a big part of Dylanology. David Kinney with me on Soundcheck, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of the new book, The Dylanologists, as well as The Big One, An Island, An Obsession, and The Furious Pursuit of a Great Fish. The Dylanologists is out now. And in terms of, you know, the never-ending tour, it's almost like The Grateful Dead. You know, people tape every show, they're swapping tapes, but, you know, the line is crossed when we have The Great White Wonder, when people start selling the stuff.
I guess so. There are bands who welcome it, and there are bands who don't. I mean, Dylan is one that doesn't. But, you know, a band like The Grateful Dead, their fan base thrived on it, and they saw it as generating sales on the other side. And I'm sure that's true. I mean, the people who buy bootlegs are not they're not buying Dylan records.
Right.
They're buying everything that he's putting out.
They're the completists.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, not that they're all completists, but they surely have all the official catalog.
Right.
You know, they're not replacing they're not going to not buy Highway 61 because they want to get the latest concert version of it.
So you mention at one point, actually at a couple of points in the book, that of all people, Bob Dylan should understand the obsessive nature of Bob Dylan fans, because you have him showing up at John Lennon's house and like kissing the spot on the ground where Elvis stood when he made one of his recordings. And he was basically a Woody Guthrie, almost stalker type when he first came to New York.
He did befriend him early on, yeah. Yeah, and think about in Chronicles and in the Sirius XM radio show that he did, 100 episodes of Other People's Music, and in interviews, he's talked about his heroes, and he's used some of the same language. He talks about meeting Johnny Ray in an elevator, and he's like, what do you say to the guy? Which is just classic. So yeah, there's an element that he gets it. I mean, he's a music nut, and mm-hmm. anybody who has met him and wanted to have a conversation with him has approached it as, you know, let's talk about music, and that's the successful way, as opposed to, hey, let's talk about your music.
Yeah. Now, you know, even early on, an early song like Blowin' in the Wind, I mean, this grows out of that obsessive love of Woody Guthrie, at least in part, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's soaking up influences from everywhere, and he's still doing that. And that's been the story from the beginning. I mean, this is a guy who has listened to obscure music his entire life. I mean, if you look at Highway 61, you find references from old blues records that mm-hmm. were, obscure pre-war records. And he's sliding in melodies, and he's sliding in things that maybe he figured nobody would notice, or maybe he figured everybody already knew, and that was the way it worked, because that's the way he started in the village.
So a title like Love and Theft, although it applies to a 2001 record, could conceivably apply to his whole career.
Well, I mean, I think it made explicit what was already true about him. I mean, you could look at a record, a minor record like Empire Burlesque, and he's taking from old films.
Well, I thought that the rain would cool things down, but it looks like it don't. I'd like to get you to change your mind, but it looks like you won't. From now on I'll be busy, ain't going nowhere fast. I'm just glad it's over, I'm seeing the real you at last.
David Kinney's book is called The Dylanologists. It is out now. It's subtitled Adventures in the Land of Bob. What does Dylan think about the Dylanologists?
Not much. You know, I think part of it probably grows out of when he came, when he arrived on the scene. You know, and it was a weird decade, and he was an eccentric guy, and he drew a bunch of eccentrics, not the least, you know, A.J. Weberman, the guy who went through his trash. You know, and I think over the years he's been frustrated by, you know, people trying to read into the music what's not there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's also been beset, like a lot of celebrities, by, you know, stalkers, people who are following him around and just invading his personal space. And I think that all that sort of gets wrapped into, well, these crazy obsessives who think about nothing but me, they're wasting their lives.
Right.
And, you know, my argument is, you know, a lot of the people that I met were, like me, just really serious music fans who at some point in our life got the bug, you know, the Dylan bug. And, you know, as one writer said, once you sign up for Dylan, you don't easily check out of the story.
And, you know, some of these people, some of these Dylanologists attribute pretty big changes in their lives to their following Dylan and their obsession with Dylan. One woman becomes a public defender because, you know, she wants to, you know, help the underdog.
Right.
And then there's another woman who gets her life together, becomes a Christian because of the album Saved. And that album, which is part of that whole Christian period in Dylan's discography that many of us sort of look down our noses at, Saved comes up several times in the course of this book. Do we need to reevaluate that period and that record?
I think it's a great record. You know, I had not listened to it that closely until the morning that I went to meet that woman in Wichita. I put it on my iPod and went for a walk and listened to it very closely. And I get it. I mean, it's a great record. There's great singing on it. And, you know, for Robin, you know, I think it's not like it was a drug that she took and suddenly her life had turned around and she had cleaned everything up. She describes it almost as something that played in the background and worked on her. And she knew she had a kid and she knew she needed to clean up and get her life together. And, you know, I think she had an unconventional religious upbringing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, her and her husband became Pentecostal. Then left that, and now sort of their church is they describe it almost as the Church of Bob. You know, if they want to go to church, they put on Saved and soak it in. And I'm all right with that.
This is the song Solid Rock from that album Saved by Bob Dylan. Won't let go, I can't let go, is this woman puts it on the T-shirt that her son wears in all of his class photos, a different size T-shirt each year.
That's right. She had an opportunity to meet Dylan. She had been trying to get him to sign her copy of Saved at a number of shows. She was sitting up front and trying to get him. And at some point, she says he told her, you know, not on stage. You got to, you know, meet me out back. And she meets him while he's walking under the bus and they have a conversation. And he says, why this record? And she wanted to tell him the whole backstory, but there was not enough time.
Yeah.
So she just told him about her son rocking out in his diapers to Saved, and he signed it and went on his way.
David Kinney's with me on Soundcheck, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of the new book, The Dylanologists. We alluded before to sometimes people leaving the Church of Bob. Andy from Britain, during the never-ending tour, is one of a growing chorus of voices who don't think the singing is great anymore. And there's a great line towards the end of the book that I want to read where he talks about a long growl to indicate that there used to be something I wanted to say here, but now this noise will suffice, which is a killer line.
Yes. You know, in a career filled with controversy, you know, him going electric, him going Christian, him going country, now the debate is over The Voice and whether he should, you know, stop doing so many shows and take a break and save that instrument.
For what?
That's probably his question. That's probably his question.
We've been speaking about The Dylanologists, Adventures in the Land of Bob by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Kinney. David, great to have you with us on Soundcheck today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
The pale moon rose in its glory out of the western town. She told a sad, sad story of the great ship that went down. 'Twas the 14th day of April, over the way she rode, sailing into tomorrow to a golden age foretold.
If you're a fan or fanatic of elegantly weathered singer-songwriters, then you should join us on June 7th. We'll be live on stage at BAM with Hamilton Lighthouser of the Walkmen, as well as the Brooklyn indie band San Fermin, who are somewhat less weathered. And now we've got another friend joining us at the Harvey Theater for Radio Love Fest, the writer, actor, and comedian Wyatt Cenac. It's going to be a great night. Tickets are going fast. Visit bam.org/RadioLoveFest to get yours. Up next, the Argentine-American songwriter Diego Garcia joins us in the studio. He'll play acoustic versions of some songs from his new album, Paradise. And I'll dig back into my crate of early electronic records from the 70s and 80s, and then we'll hear about one of the very first recordings in blues history. It's a century old. That's coming up on Soundcheck.
Let's make it a point to remember tomorrow may never descend.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In 2011, the singer and songwriter Diego Garcia had just started his solo career with a breakup album. This was after the breakup of his indie rock band, Elephant, but that album called Laura somehow seemed more personal. So, how's Diego doing now? Well, his latest album's called Paradise. Guess he's doing okay. In fact, Diego Garcia is in such a good mood that he's worked up a special bossa nova arrangement of one of his songs just for us. Here he is with fellow guitarist Zeke Zima and a song called Donde Estás, Diego Garcia, live on Soundcheck.
Woman, I know you can say that she's missing. Though I know where to find her, she's never alone. Though the stories behind her are not very pretty, I'll be wondering about her every place that I go. Donde estás, mi amor? Donde estás, mi amor? Many years have gone by, she's the same as she once was. Though my memory's clear, she's consumed by her thoughts. And the aching that binds her because of her lost love gives me reason to find her at whatever the cost. Donde estás, donde estás, mi amor? Donde estás, mi amor? Donde estás, mi amor? Donde estás, mi amor? There's a woman I know, you can say that she's missing. Though I know where to find her, she's never alone. Though the stories behind her are not very pretty, till the day that I find her, guess I'll be on my own. Donde estás, mi amor? Donde estás, mi amor? Donde estás, mi amor? Donde estás, mi amor? Hey, bring out the sunshine now.
is Diego Garcia, live on soundcheck at his song Donde Estás? Donde Estás, mi amor? Where is my love? And Zeke Zima playing guitar along with Diego Garcia live here in the soundcheck studio. A special bossa nova arrangement of that song, which appears on Diego Garcia's last album, which is called Paradise. And so Zeke becomes Ziquinho for this arrangement.
He transforms.
You get a little Brazilian action there. So is this a kind of a nod to Brazil in a World Cup year?
Yeah, I guess, well, you know, my wife's Brazilian.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she is. And I've always...
This is the Laura of the preceding record.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I got her back. and we're now married, have two children. It's been crazy. And so... not only has she been an influence, but I've always felt very connected to Stan Getz and Vinicius de Moraes and Luis Bonfa and Juan Carlos Jobim. And all those guys, for me, paved the way to, I think, indie rock. And I don't mean it in like, it really is. Like, if you listen to Belle and Sebastian, for example.
Right.
I mean, the way that they deliver, that soft sort of subtle delivery, I think that can be credited a lot to those. Those guys, the Brazilians, were just smooth.
Yeah. Now, you grew up with Argentine parents. You're a first-generation American, right?
Exactly.
So you would have grown up with those sounds in the house. Argentine, I think you mentioned last time you hear Chilean singers as well. When you wrote this song, I mean, it wasn't on the album. It's not a bossa nova. But it sounds like maybe you were going for that kind of Nueva Canción kind of sound.
Yeah, I've been riding a wave of trying to connect to my roots. You know, I found it sort of what inspired me to the way I arranged Laura, the first album. And I'm just continuing that sort of journey, and it's exciting to look back. Donde Estás, that delivery, has a Barry Manilow, sort of Harry Nilsson vibe on the album. And it's just all those influences come together when I make music, because I grew up in the States. So
right, and you grew up in Detroit.
I was born in Detroit. I was there for very little and then grew up pretty much in Florida.
Okay. Because I was going to say, you know, with Detroit, you know, you would expect to hear echoes of Motown, techno, house, you know, all that
kind
of
stuff. Well, my first band, I used to be a punk. You know,
right.
Before I got old and I realized, oh my God, I can't do this forever. But my first band, I was covering Iggy Pop.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Elephant had, you know, still had that kind of punk.
Yeah,
aesthetic.
We were like an elegant punk.
Elegant punk band.
Yeah, I
okay.
think so.
We're speaking with Diego Garcia. His most recent album is called Paradise, which came out in the fall. He's performing across the street on Friday night at City Winery. And Paradise, the most recent album. Now, Laura, the prior album, was allegedly a breakup album, although, as we now know, you and Laura actually got married. So it wasn't, you know, as breakup albums go. So I'm not going to get fooled again here. Paradise, what's this album really about?
Well, after touring Laura, I came off the road, and I'm with child, I'm married. And I,
just so you know, when you say I'm with child, that means
sounds,
something different, I think, than what you.
No, I actually carried the baby. Yeah, and I'm
okay.
with child. I have a kid and a beautiful wife, and I think you hear that in Paradise, which is a record about, you know, I was celebrating things. I was also kind of looking back to the way it was, just to remind myself how quickly it could just all kind of go as well.
Well, this next song you're going to do is actually from the last record, from Laura, right?
Yes, I thought it would be nice to play a song that I think resonated with so many people and got me to where I am now.
All right. So you want to do it for us now?
Sure.
All right. Sure. Diego Garcia is my guest. He's got Zeke Zima along with him playing guitar as well. This song is from the 2011 album called Laura. The song is called You Were Never There. It's Diego Garcia once again playing live in the Soundcheck studio.
1, 2, 3, 4. Stop where you are, looking up at the sun.
all the cars standing still as they run. The day starts to fade, slip away out of sight. A flash in the sky, lighting up my dark night. And you were never there, you were never there, you were never there, you were never there. Had it all, more than most that I know. You hide yourself behind a wall and it shows. Girl, you never cared, you were never there, because you never cared, you were never there. It was a rainy night on a quiet town in Florida. I stayed awake all night, I couldn't sleep at all, so I sang to her. Girl, you never cared, you were never there, because you never cared, you were never there, you were never there, you were never there, you were never there, you were never there.
That is Diego Garcia with his song You Were Never There. Going back a few years for that one from his 2011 record called Laura. In fact, if you go hunting through our Soundcheck archives at soundcheck.org, you'll find a 2011 live performance of that song here in our studio.
How boring.
But a somewhat different sound from what we just heard. Diego Garcia singing and playing the guitar. Zeke Zima playing guitar, as he did for Diego 3 years ago, last time he was here. Back to the new record, the latest one called Paradise. Let's hear another song. This one is called Thoughts of You, live on Soundcheck.
You're swimming in a disappointment when life is taking certain turns. We better not go through the motions. We both know he can lead to burns. For every day we spend apart now, an empty place within my heart, an image of you indecisive, a need to show you how I care. These thoughts of you are always there, consume my life at every second I'm aware, shining brightly from some about you are a star and deserving of my everlasting love. As months go by, my life is torture. Without you smiling by my side, to keep reminding you I'm yours, girl, that I got nothing to hide. These thoughts of you are always there, consume my life at every second I'm aware, shining brightly from above. You are a star and deserving of my everlasting love. Shining brightly from above. You are a star and deserving of my everlasting love. Shining brightly from above. You are a star and deserving of my everlasting love.
That's called Thoughts of You, another live performance in the Soundcheck studio from singer and guitarist and songwriter Diego Garcia, with Zeke Zima playing guitar as well. That appears on Diego's most recent album, Paradise, although in a rather different form from what we just heard, this acoustic, unplugged version. We're speaking with Diego Garcia. As you know, Diego, you share a name with an island in the Indian Ocean.
I have ashtrays already made after my name. I have T-shirts. My merch is already made, right? And I have Google alerts. The U.S. is using Diego Garcia for secret operations. I like to pass around. And I was also a question, and this is for you. I was a question on Jeopardy.
Really?
Or an answer, I guess.
An answer, yes.
And I was an elephant, and I was, I think, $1,000. Men Who Are Islands was the category.
Wow.
And this Atoli Island is the name of a lead singer in this band, Elephant. And the guy said Diego Garcia.
Wow.
With my face. That's, it was a picture answer.
That's amazing, yeah. that the guy got it right,
and
too.
He got it right, but I think they're very, you know.
Paradise is Diego Garcia's latest album. He is playing across the street on Friday night at City Winery. He's been playing for us here in the studio today. Diego, great to see you again. Thank you so much. Like what you've been hearing, head over to soundcheck.org for an extended interview. I quizzed Diego Garcia relentlessly about the island that shares his name, and in return, he played us another song called My Heart is an Island. Earlier on Soundcheck, we were looking through the history of Dylanology, the study, perhaps the obsessive study, of Bob Dylan's songs. In a moment, we'll be looking back at an early blues song that's now 100 years old. But we're also looking back this week at some classic electronic music of the 70s and 80s, because you can hear those sounds recurring in a surprising amount of today's electronic artists. One of the major developments in electronic music over the past 25 years has been the style known as techno, sometimes called Detroit techno because that's where it really started back in the late 80s. Much of the EDM, or electronic dance music, that now rules the world has its roots in techno. But where did techno come from? In part, it came from Germany. This record by Manuel Goetsching was released in 1984, and it's kind of a missing link between the German bands of the 70s, like Kraftwerk and Goetsching's own group, Asherah Temple, and the Detroit techno kids of the late 80s. The piece is called E2-E4, and like its techno descendants, it's all about the beat and the gradual layering of electronic sounds over it. Hypnotic, long-form, trancey, and completely electronic, it's a kind of proto-techno music. Over the years, this recording has gone out of print, but its reputation has become almost the stuff of legend. So much so, in fact, that Manuel Goetsching actually performed E2-E4, here in New York just a couple of years ago, to a huge throng of people on the plaza of Lincoln Center. You can hear more of this track and check out my list of 10 classic electronic albums of the 70s and 80s on our website, soundcheck.org. Coming up next, I'll talk with David Krasnow, he's senior editor down the hall at Studio 360, about W.C. Handy's Yellow Dog Blues. That song turns 100 this year, and David's show is asking listeners to reinterpret it. Hear how you can get in on the action next on Soundcheck.
Ever since Miss Susan Johnson lost to Chucky Lee.
This is Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer. In the background, you're listening to a version of the blues standard Yellow Dog Blues. It's just one of the submissions so far in a listener challenge issued by our friends over at Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. It's called the 1914 Blues Challenge, and here to tell us all about it is Studio 360's senior editor, David Krasnow. Hi, David.
Hey, John. How are you?
So someone calling themselves City of Light submitted this version of Yellow Dog Blues. What is the 1914 Blues Challenge? What are you asking people to do?
So these listener challenges are something that we do on a really regular basis at Studio 360. They're really important to us. We did a scary short film contest that Wes Craven judged. We finished that up recently. We did a remix contest with DJ Rupture. So every medium across the board, we're trying to keep our listeners as busy as possible, out of trouble, get them some extra points. This is the first cover version challenge that we've ever done. And it's part of a show that we're doing coming up just in a couple of weeks about the culture of 1914. It's kind of a walk through everything that was happening a century ago as though Studio 360, you know, had been on the air since then.
Right.
And all kinds of interesting stuff was happening. And among those things, you know, it's the very earliest period when songs called blues are being published and are becoming a big thing in America. It's the first time people are outside of the rural South are really hearing that term.
So 100 years ago, this song is published. So it's now in the public domain. Folks can just have at it, do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And so you're looking for creative, inventive rearrangements.
You know, we're really agnostic about what people do with the song. You know, if you look at the versions that people already have up, you know, there's a ton of traditional blues versions. There are, you know, people doing, you know, Dixieland style versions of it who look like, you know, as old as my kid. And then obviously some people, you know, we hope that we get versions like the City of Light that you just played, which is totally not in a blues idiom, but still a really sensitive, cool treatment of the song. And
the bar has been set fairly high by people like Bessie Smith, the great blues singer of the 1920s, who is one of many people who have covered this song early in the 20th century. Let's hear a little bit of her version of W.C. Handy's Yellow Dog Blues.
Ever since Miss Susie
just a little bit of Bessie Smith's 1929 recording of W.C. Handy's Yellow Dog Blues, which is now a century old and the subject of Studio 360's 1914 Blues Challenge. The deadline is Sunday, June 1st, 11:59 p.m. Eastern. You are invited to take this song and revisit it in whatever way you want. For all the details, go to studio360.org. Their senior editor is David Krasnow here with me. So why the Yellow Dog Blues? I mean, W.C. Handy is famous for the Memphis Blues. The St. Louis Blues came out the same year.
The St. Louis Blues is the same year, and believe me, we did talk about that and wrestle with it a little bit. A couple of things. One is that the St. Louis Blues actually becomes popular later. It was a slower burn than Yellow Dog Blues. Ultimately, the better-known song. Mm-hmm. It's also a little harder to play, though. It has a central section that is in a different rhythm that Handy apparently learned in Cuba, or it was derived from music that he heard in Cuba.
He did spend some time in Cuba.
Yeah, he called it Tangana. But it's a harder song to cover, and we really wanted, this is like a very straight classic 12-bar blues. And, you know, everybody can cover it from Bessie Smith to, you know, like your kid brother on the guitar. So we wanted to make it a song that was really accessible.
Now, you know, I keep saying W.C. Handy's Yellow Dog Blues.
Right.
He was a very smart guy.
Yeah.
You know, one of the first people to cotton on to the fact that if you published a song, you would get the money, whether it was actually your song or not.
Yeah.
I mean, he basically did a very inventive cover of a couple of pre-existing songs. We just heard Bessie Smith singing that line about, I wonder where my Easy Rider's gone.
Right, which was a huge hit at that time by a different guy. Easy Rider, by the way, I had to look up finally and figure out like what they were really talking about, like how dirty a reference was that. And at the time, it meant more like a kind of a freeloader or, you know, kind of a layabout type of guy. And then, yeah, so he takes that song, and this is kind of an answer to it. He adds to it a line that he heard at a railroad station years earlier, an actual kind of rural folk blues musician, which Handy was not. He was a band leader. He was extremely sophisticated musically. He taught, you know,
musically
taught in college,
literate. Yeah.
So he's taking this fragment of folk music that, and apparently he remembered the line for years.
Well, I think I know the line you're getting to here. That's going where the Southern cross the dog.
Yeah.
Which is actually the subtitle of the song.
Right, right.
So what does that line mean?
It was the intersection of two railroad lines. And of course, you know, people in the rural South were not driving around in cars back then. So if you went somewhere, you were hopping a train. The Southern Railroad was one. The other, the Yellow Dog referred to the Yazoo Delta, which was a sort of a spur in the Mississippi Delta area, and because it was the Yazoo Delta, they called it Yellow Dog.
So that's behind this line, which we'll hear in this recording of Yellow Dog Blues from Louis Armstrong and his All-Stars, recorded in 1954.
Yeah, see him here, and he was on the hall. I said he riders gotta stay away, so he had to vamp it, but the high came far. He's gone where the Southern cross to Yellow Dog.
That's from a 1954 album. Louis Armstrong plays W.C. Handy. Louis Armstrong and his All-Stars with their version of Yellow Dog Blues. And David, we heard him add the word yellow back in, going where the Southern crossed the dog.
Yeah.
Becomes cross the Yellow Dog. So listeners to Studio 360 are invited to kind of tweak the words because there's a history of that as well.
Yeah, obviously, you know, it's a song, you know, it was originally a folk song. It enters the history of publication. You have these very classic versions, but people, you know, in honor of the folk tradition, you know, if you want to mash it together with a completely different song, like if it works, go for it, you know.
And who decides whether it works?
Well, the judge of this contest is Mark Anthony Thompson, the songwriter who also does work as Chocolate Genius.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want someone who was completely in the blues idiom, who was going to be judging it, how faithful is it to one of these canonical versions. You know, he's an artist who I think he really, like, I think there's a blues sensitivity to what he does, mm-hmm. a sensibility, mm-hmm. But definitely not a blues artist in any way. He's a great songwriter and I think a really great arranger of songs, of pop music. And so I think he's going to be as open-minded as anyone who submits.
All right. Well, the plan is to have Chocolate Genius and Kurt Anderson, the host of Studio 360, back once you guys have collected a few more entries and get down towards the deadline, which is Sunday, June 1st at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time. That is the deadline for listeners to take Studio 360's 1914 Blues Challenge. Give the Yellow Dog Blues your best shot. And are people basically posting these to your website, to SoundCloud? How's
that
working?
The instructions are on our website, okay. But it is a SoundCloud embed. If people go to our page at studio360.org, they'll find all the instructions.
All right. The 1914 Blues Challenge based on W.C. Handy's Yellow Dog Blues. David Krasnow is senior editor at Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. David, thanks very much.
John, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Super excited to hear what people come up with.
This is Soundcheck. Tomorrow on the show, Stephen Malkmus influenced an entire generation of indie rockers with his band Pavement. We'll catch up with the singer-songwriter and his current band, The Jicks. They have a new album out. They'll play some of it live. That does it for the show today. Our theme music is Eagle Rock by Marco Benevento. The show is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer.